behind their jeep. The settlers were there and start like the settlers themselves like cursing me while the soldiers were handcuffed me and covering my eyes before put me inside the jeep and start driving away. I couldn't see, I couldn't know where I'm going. And then in the way they stopped and they transferred like me in another soldier's car and also kept driving until we arrived in a place which is their military base, and like they took me down from their car, started pushing me hardly. I tried to ask them where they're going with me, what they're doing. I can't see why you are pushing me like this. I don't see where I am walking, where I'm putting my legs. And they just keep telling me to shut up and cursing me that I'm a dog, and they know who I am because I filmed them like all the time when they come to destroy houses, when they are coming like to back the settlers, and when they also come to invade the villages in the night or in the day. So there is really the scary thing for me that that there is a hate, and I'm a Palestinian journalist, and there is a hate from them toward me just because I take my phone or my camera and go film them when they're doing like these crimes, because they know that they're doing something, they don't want it to be published outside. So they let me sit in a chair. I tried to ask them where I am, what is going on with me. They asked me about my phone, while my phone was with the officer and my ID also, and they kept like telling me that I'm a liar and that I am bad, and this like, why you are not going to Jenin? What if I am writing to Al Jazeera? And then like I stayed there for hours before the officer came again and put me in the jeep, and then take me to the entrance of the village, release me with my phone. Later on, the army spokesperson said I was taken to police to give a testimony. I was not detained, which is really totally lie. They took my phone illegally. I don't know what they did with it. And I was just sitting in the sun being cursed by these occupation soldiers, who's for them, it's really fun like to do that. I was asking them, I was telling them, you would never, ever be brave to do this to an international or Israeli journalist. I don't wish that, but this is will never happen here. Just because I'm a Palestinian, it doesn't matter, journalist, Palestinian shepherd, Palestinian farmer, a landowner, doesn't matter. I am Palestinian in the end of the day, and there is a foreign army, which is the Israeli occupation forces, that controls our life and can do whatever they want because they have the power to do it. And this is not the first time for me personally to face this. Just last May, I was beaten up for like 40 minutes, really assaulted very hardly. It was filmed on a video when they were beating me up just because I reached my neighbor to film the four soldiers trying to take down his shelter. And they decided to arrest me in that moment. I was like protesting, telling them, this is illegal, you don't have excuse. I am a journalist, just come here for documentation. And it was like just masked soldiers who with the rifles and uniform and beating me really hard, grabbing me on the ground, like putting my body on the ground, catching my legs and my hands, try to grab me to their military jeep. I was too scared for that, and I was like hospitalized after 40 minutes of them beating me up. And also, like, if you want another example about me personally, like on December 2021 at night, they invaded my home, they confiscated the cameras and the laptop and the car that I use alongside with other activists here for the documentation in Masafariyat, and the police and the army kept them for at least 1 month in their offices before the court ordered them to bring this back. But for now, like four Palestinian journalists sitting in Israeli jail in administrative detention without any charge, without any accuse, just because they are Palestinians. We don't see the European Union, the U.S. sending condemnations about these acts, that journalists sitting in jail without charge just because they are Palestinians. And where is the freedom of press? Last month, just in June, my friend and close colleague, Ihab Alami, for example, from Beit Omar, northern of Hebron, was shot in his leg by an Israeli soldier while the soldiers were invading his town, and he was filming them. The camera were there, very clear that he's a journalist. He was wearing a vest, telling that it's a press, like he's a journalist. And even though they shot him, no one talked about this. No one wrote about it. You don't see the Western like embassies here in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv writing about it, that there was a journalist like was shot, unless like someone like Shireen Abu Akleh, that we love her so much, that were shot in Jenin because she's a woman, she has American passport, then everyone talk about her. But this daily harassments, and like, this is just, I was like detained for 2 hours and sit up under the sun, but all the time I go out in the field, they try to push me back really hardly. They create flying checkpoints to stop us as journalists and taking our IDs, wasting our time to prevent us follow the forces that, for example, demolishing a home or cutting a water well in Masafer Yatta. So this is, we've been like really, we're really tired and rescue our life to go film these crimes. And they are really making it very hard for us to do this. And it doesn't matter for them what a price we will pay for this, because they know that there is no consequences for their acts and their violence toward us.
And Basil Adra, I wanted to ask you, obviously this crackdown of the government, continued crackdown on Palestinian journalists, is as a result of what the Israeli government is doing and what you are chronicling. Could you talk about the, you report that over 1,000 people are at risk of immediate banishment, and the army has already started demolishing homes and schools to make way for more settlements. Could you talk about what you've seen in the in these demolitions?
Yes, so for me personally, since I born until today, I witnessed and I document hundreds of demolitions of Palestinian houses and the properties in Masafer Yatta, and it's the most hard thing to see and to witness. And especially now when I go to film this, I see families, children, like, and mothers stand aside and watching Israeli bulldozers demolishing their homes or their school or their water well, and they are just crying, and I'm there just filming, feeling really powerless and hopeless on this situation. And just a few hundred meters away from my home and my community, there is the Israeli outpost and settlement that keep expanding. What I've seen since I born until today, just the Israeli settlements are expanding. They're getting water, a clean water, and asphalt roads and homes. Every day they're building and expanding more and more on our land. And the bulldozers there for them just come to dig the land and to create more houses and farms, huge cow farms, chicken farms, vineyard and cherries, all kind of farms around these settlements are expanding toward our land. While I see and I witness a weekly of Israeli bulldozers coming toward Masafer Yatta to our communities and demolishing houses, schools, water wells, water pipes, like bulldozering roads in order to squeeze our communities and to drive us away from here. So what happened is in the 80s, they designated 14 communities of Masafer Yatta out of 20 as a firing zone, which is military area. Like they want to take this land for the Israeli occupation forces to do military exercises. But Israeli politician Ariel Sharon at that time wrote in his secret documents that he's designating Masafer Yatta as a firing zone area under the pretext to take this land for the Israeli settlements. These documents that he wrote in the 80s when he made this first designation, it was released a year ago from now. So from the 80s until last year, they were trying very hard by putting pressure on the Palestinians of Masafer Yatta life in order to make them like leave this land. So they were cutting the water wells, they were like preventing access to electricity, demolishing houses, preventing to giving us permission for building homes. And in under the, like, they want to drive the people away from their homes. And it didn't work, all of this pressure. The Palestinians doesn't have any other like place to go. And they would go to the old caves, renovate them, set up new tents and stay at their homes. Until last year, last May, an Israeli like high court decided to give the green line for the Israeli occupation forces to physically transfer the residents of Masafer Yatta and destroy their homes in order to take this land. And the one that wrote this judgment, the political judgment, is himself a settler, live in the West Bank near Ramallah. Himself is violating the international law by living in the West Bank, but he's being a judge, a settler judge that wrote the future of 1,300 residents of Masafer Yatta and to give the green light for the Israeli occupation forces to drive these people away and to make them homeless in order to take this land. Since that decision in last May until now, it tells you over than 50 houses were wiped out by the Israeli occupation forces, which is very crazy. And last November, I stand and document in a village of Sfai here in Masafriyat, an early morning, normal morning, while students were having their class, their lessons in their classrooms. As normally, heavily occupation forces arrived at the school with a bulldozer. The soldiers ran directly to the classrooms, slammed the doors, and started pushing us back as a journalist and parents. And the first moment, one soldier opened the first stun grenade and threw it at us. When it exploded, the students from the class started to open the windows, crying, taking their books, and running away from the school crying, and very traumatic scene. I never been in that scene before. It was really horrifying. And then the soldiers just make a wall around the school. A group of soldiers went inside the school, steal the bags of the kids with the balloons, with their chairs, with their tables, and going out, confiscate them and put them in the Israeli military trucks before a bulldozer was owned and driven by a Satter who live in the outpost nearby. In a minute, just bulldozered this school and leave away. These students watched their dream being damaged in front of their eyes. There was just a school that they can be educated in it. And their parents didn't have that chance to have a school and to be educated, and none of them educated. And they had this chance for a while to be educated in this school, and they were planning to improve it and to have more classrooms, because it was for a primary school and they wanted to improve it. But the Israeli occupation forces arrived and wiped it out. The students with the parents built another tent, and the army arrived and took it and confiscated another tent, and it was also confiscated by the Israeli occupation forces. So now they continued the year in a room by one of the villagers that donated to the teacher, and an old caravan that the water link in the winter and the sun heated up in the summer. So they since May until
Basil,
now.
Basil, I just wanted to bring in Nora Erekat, because we only have a little bit of time left. Nora, I wanted to ask you the role of the Palestinian Authority while all of this is going on the West Bank, when these with so many more Palestinians are being displaced and their homes demolished. What has been the role of the Palestinian Authority?
Well, unfortunately, Basil can I'm sure discuss this as well. Their complete absence in Masafriyat to prevent or to protect Palestinians, to the extent that they've been armed, they use those arms in order to protect the illegal Israeli settlers, in order to demonstrate that they are the good natives that the U.S. and Israel can trust. Since the establishment of the Oslo Peace Agreement, which is an autonomy arrangement of perpetual subjugation, the Palestinian Authority has become an arm and an extension of the occupation in its policing and its suppression of freedom of speech, in actually tearing apart the fabric of Palestinian social, national, political life in order to do what most people in power do, which is to preserve that power. They've not even endorsed BDS. As articulated by the 2005 BDS call, because to them that would undermine their authority to lead their own state. To the extent that they have been, where are they in the discussion about insisting that Israel is an apartheid state? They also have been falling behind and using it very in self-interested ways in order to advance themselves and their irrelevance, and yet they are not relevant. To the extent that we've seen them actually extrajudicially assassinate a Palestinian journalist, Nizar Banat, and then come down hard on the Palestinian people who protested that assassination at the height of Palestinian grassroots and social power internationally in May 2021 during the protest against the impending takeover of Sheikh Jarrah. And so the Palestinian Authority is part of the problem, and it makes the Palestinian condition even more hard, but even more spectacular, that despite all of these obstacles, Palestinians are able, through their grassroots initiatives, through popular media, through film, through art, through organizing across the globe to be able to continue to get this story out, to be able to continue to articulate a unified vision for the future, a decolonial future, one based on the freedom, dignity, and justice for all people,
Just for a few. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestinian human rights attorney, associate professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law on the Question of Palestine, speaking to us from Portugal. And Basil Adra, reporter from Masafayata for Local Call and 972 magazine, will link to your new pieces, I Was Handcuffed and Blindfolded for Reporting on Settler Violence, and your new piece for The Nation magazine, The Destruction of This Palestinian Community Was Greenlighted by Israel. Israel's Supreme Court. Coming up, Professor John Womack joins us, the legendary historian of the Mexican Revolution, on how to seize and build labor power and solidarity. Stay with us.
You can have all the money in your hands, all the possessions anyone can ever have, but it's all worthless treasure. True worth is only measured not by what you got, but what you got in your heart. You can have everything. But what does it mean? It all means nothing if you don't stand up for something. You can't just talk the talk. You got to walk that walk. Yes, you do.
For Something by Andra Day. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. As we turn now to the workers flexing power across the United States in what some are calling a hot labor summer, actors in SAG-AFTRA have entered their fifth day on strike after the union joined tens of thousands of members of the Writers Guild of America in a combined strike. Meanwhile, the head of the Teamsters has asked the White House not to intervene if some 340,000 unionized UPS workers go on strike without a breakthrough on contract negotiations by the end of the month. This comes as workers at a Waffle House restaurant in Columbia, South Carolina, went on a three-day strike over the weekend to protest low pay and unsafe working conditions they say the companies refused to address.
I've been with the company 24 years. In this time, I'm only making $16 an hour. I've been through two robberies, and I've had guns in my face in 24 years. I definitely think they could do better than $16 an hour. I'm almost 47 with a herniated disc in my back. You think they're going to get me any mat or anything good to stand on back there on the concrete floor while they work me 17-hour shifts back-to-back? No. I think Waffle House Incorporated could do me better than that. Blood, sweat, and tears for this company over the years. They could do a little bit better than what they've done. Yeah. 24 years, that's right. Why I'm out here striking today.
For more, we're joined by the legendary historian and labor organizer John Womack, one of the foremost historians of the Mexican Revolution, has also written extensively about labor power and strategy, which is the title of his new book. It's featured in The Nation in a piece headlined, What Does It Take to Win a Strike? When Womack was recognized by the Mexico City government for his work in 2009 as it marked the bicentennial of Mexican independence and of the Mexican Revolution, he passed on his award to the Electricians Union in support of their struggle. At the time, they'd been locked out by the Public Power Agency in Mexico City and surrounding states as they demanded better working conditions. The Washington Post once called John Womack a Marxist historian. He is professor emeritus of Latin American History and Economics at Harvard University, where he is joining us now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Womack. Why don't you lay out your arguments in this book and why, as a historian of the Mexican Revolution, for which you are world-renowned, you are now focusing on labor power and strategy?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I started out working on Mexico, Mexican history, and concentrated on the Mexican Revolution. And while doing some research, Now, in Mexico City during the revolution, that there were three general strikes in the city of then about 350,000. But crucial in them was the Electrical Workers Union. Then I thought, well, this is interesting. Where are they? And it turned there were various places in the city, but the main place was a power plant about 60 miles or so north of the city, and where there were only about 100 workers. But when they shut down the power plant, they shut down Mexico City. I thought, well, that's very interesting. And then there were major railroad strikes in the 1920s, and but crucial there was the machinist workers who were in the railroad shops. They weren't on the railroads, but they were in the shops maintaining the trains, the telegraphers, the dispatchers. There were 500 dispatchers across the country could shut down a railroad that employed 30,000. So I thought, this is very interesting, and I wonder where else is happening. And so from there, I looked at other industries and then outside Mexico, and it happens anywhere that there is a technical division of labor on a small scale or on an industrial scale, where a few workers are at bottlenecks or choke points, where if they act, if they stop work, lots of other workers have to stop work. And it's clearest in transportation, where in quintessentially the crane operators in San Francisco or Los Angeles, they can tie up the whole supply chain. But it's not on railroads. The people that the sending messages are crucial. The trains have to run on time and quite on time, or they run into each other and there are derailments. That impressed me, but it goes much further. It's not only highly skilled people like crane operators or dispatchers, the people in the warehouses, if they don't unload and load the freight, nothing moves. And things block up. It's choked there at the warehouse. That's how Hoffa built the Teamsters. It wasn't so much from the drivers. It was the people in the warehouses. But it goes further. It goes into services like healthcare or public schools. The big California school strike this past year had a major impact on California's budget, quite aside from the classrooms and everything, but it had a major impact on California state system. Few years ago, West Virginia and the Oklahoma teacher strikes. They had a major impact on the states where they happened, and on the families which need schools if nothing else than to take care of their kids. Quite aside from the education that the teachers are giving, and all those are skilled. But there are other choke points in buildings in a major office building in any big city or small city for that matter, The janitors don't clean the building, it's unbearable after a few days. And bus drivers, that's a skilled work, but if bus drivers don't serve the public school system, that throws a lot of disturbance into the cities.
John Womack, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this analysis of yours, clearly capitalists are able to adapt and develop strategies to reduce the power of these workers that are in key sectors. For instance, in the transportation industry, clearly the businesses have gone more and more to independent truckers to prevent precisely the kind of situation being faced now with the Teamsters and the UPS drivers. What areas do you think labor is missing in being able to have this strategic approach to organizing? First, I think your book talks a lot about IT departments within companies, and the obviously the tech workers in any company are critical to that company being able to function. But yet their labor law is weak in the U.S. on this issue. What are the sectors in society today that you see as critical to an organized labor movement becoming stronger?
Technical work, of course. Anything that has to do with computers is crucial. And there are all sorts of levels of skill in the technically organized industries. There are still old-fashioned parts of the economy. Automobile parts, for instance, throughout the South. There are a number of plants there that could remake the UAW if they had a plan for organizing. Maybe they do. It's not clear. But if they had a plan for organizing those automobile parts, that would double the size of the UAW. In IT, it's also maintenance, and that is a skill. And for instance, in robotic factories robotically organized now warehouses, those machines are machines. They have to be maintained, and the people who are in the shops where they maintain those things have a crucial power, a strategic power. And that's what the strategic is about. It's about these particular choke points in any industry or in any plant.
We're going to talk more about choke points in part two of our conversation. We're talking to John Womack, legendary historian and labor organizer. His new book, Labor, Power, and Strategy. He is professor emeritus of Latin American history and economics at Harvard University. He is the author of The Mexican Revolution and Zapata. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Chirina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see the podcasts of our broadcast, video and audio, go to democracynow.org. The transcripts are there as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.